Good morning. All right, so I'm standing between you and the Bay Area. I can deal with that. As you may notice, I don't have an English accent, nor do I come from Berkeley. So what I will try and do my best is to make up in earnestness and passion what I lack in breeding and intellect. I want to talk a little bit, it's actually a really good tie into the keynote, because I want to talk a little bit about some of the whys behind this whole Web 2.0 and all that wonderful stuff, which we'll get into, and really begin to delve into some of the impacts. Because I think we have a really interesting moment. I mean, if you've been in libraries, and I'm guessing you have been for more than 5 years, you're probably used to every conference you go to starting with, and now the great challenge is, and libraries will be totally different in, and the worst thing is when it actually happens every 5 years that you are in a whole new profession. So yet again, we're in this new time. But I think this one's fundamentally different. I want to talk about why. So in lieu of my credentials in breeding, I'm going to instead pick on Socrates. This is an image of the Academy. And what's interesting about the Academy, of which I am a part and you are a part, is it's a very interesting world that we live in. And I'm always comforted because I go into practitioner conferences a lot and, you know, reference librarians look at me and they sort of, you know, they see that Syracuse University and that iSchool after it and they start going, I don't know if I can trust this guy. Because let's face it, academics don't exactly have the best reputation as someone who can help practitioners on a daily basis. Someone once said, how many academics does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is one. They simply hold the light up and wait for the world to revolve around them. But what keeps me humble in this whole world is thinking back to the origin of the word. I'm sure you folks know it, but if you don't, the Academy is actually named after a place that Plato hung out in Athens. And sort of thought about the life. And this is what I love about this picture, is this is a, you know, sort of fictional representation of Socrates and Plato and a lot of philosophers sitting and musing deeply and thinking in the Academy. And you can tell it's a Renaissance piece because the Academy was actually an outdoor garden and gymnasium in Athens. And I love this idea that Western thought and academies and deep pondering happened like at the YMCA of Athens. You know, but it's this sort of playground idea. It's not just that we talk and think serious matters. It's that we're in the midst of action and that we're in the midst of thinking ideas and we're in the midst of playing with those ideas. And I want to give ourselves liberty this morning to play and think with those ideas. I bring this up also because I have this really interesting finding and revelation recently, which is, I've spent a year, I'm currently on sabbatical, so you're lucky I'm wearing pants, forget the tie. And I've been spending it with the Office for Information Technology in ALA working on a project, and part of the project is talking about what's the impact of this stuff we're going to talk about, participatory librarianship, but particularly in LIS education. And so I would gather in a group of colleagues and deans and professors, and I'd sort of start with a, well, what do you think life is like? And being rather timid and, frankly, not having the best interaction of groups here. And it finally occurred to me that what I was trying to do was sort of not impose ideas and see if I could draw out and do consensus, and that's not how the Academy works. I mean, the Academy is very much grounded in the Socratic method. Right, it's grounded around this concept of the dialectic argument. An argument is a good word for what it is grounded in. Right, it's one of those things that in the Academy we do take polar positions and fight to the truth. And you know, you could bring up, you know, mom and apple pie, and someone will throw back Oedipus and cholesterol at you, and you'll find out what's going on. And so, what I'd like to do this morning is to take on this discussion pattern. What I'm going to do, and rather forcefully, is I'm going to put out an argument, a position. And I'm not going to spend a huge time qualifying it throughout. And that's not because there aren't qualifiers, and it's not because there aren't other opinions. It's just I don't want to bother you with sitting and watching me vacillate back and forth on the details. What I'd much more rather do is engage in conversation, and while it would be great to actually just get rid of the microphone and sit down, that's not what they pay me for. So I'm going to give you a one-sided argument. But the hope is that it's really part of a longer discourse and a larger discussion so that we can talk. So some of the stuff I'm going to say is pretty, you know, out there and provocative. But the point is to get us thinking. Not the point is to say we know the truth. I think I do. But waiting for it to revolve. But it really is the idea that I'm really tired of having conversations where we talk and talk and talk. As someone said, people often mistake actions for words and then or replace actions with words and then argue about the words. You know, I'm tired of it. What I'm much more interested in the action. I think we're at a point that we need to get moving. And I think we're at the point where we need to do some major changing and some major thinking and not spend a whole heck of a lot of time reflecting and contemplating, because if we don't move, it's going to get very, very uncomfortable where we are. I also bring on this idea of the Socratic and dialectic method because to me it really represents the power of conversation. And this power of conversation is a foundation of what I think is fundamentally changing on the web and changing in our profession. And that is that we're in the conversation business. Now, a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask, who is a cybernetician, and you think I'm obscure, and was British and wore a bow tie, really started thinking about, in the 70s, how we could teach machines to think. And what he started with was, well, until we figure it out, why don't we start with how people think? Or as we say, why don't I use natural intelligence until artificial intelligence catches up? And so he sat down and he said, well, how do people come up and build knowledge? How do people gain an understanding? And he said, they do it through conversation. Now, conversation in being just me and you talking one-on-one, me as a group, two parties having discussions. But in the theoretical level, he really meant the idea of two cognitive agents. Don't worry, I get back to the practical stuff in a while. Going back and forth. Right, two people we hope are cognitive agents, but it could be within your head. And if any of you have dealt with information literacy, you're familiar with things like metacognition and critical thinking and the idea that we talk with ourselves. And he even went to the point of the idea of sensory, where if I go like this, you saw it, you heard it, and you basically your senses get together and said, is that the same thing? Sure, let's agree on it. Okay, so that was my hand make that sound. Right? And so what happens in this back and forth and ongoing dialogue, whether it's happening within your head, whether it's happening within individuals, within institutions, within countries, within societies, is we have a constant back and forth and challenge where we come up with agreements, we deal with these agreements, and we scaffold new knowledge on it. All right? So you guys, it's interesting here, I'm at Innovative Interfaces. There's a really great form of showing what a conversation can be. It's called this thing called a contract, where we go back and forth and try and come up with our agreements, and we end up with stacks like this that we assume represent everything possibly that could ever happen within this relationship. Well, what's interesting about that is if knowledge is created through conversation, and I would argue that libraries being in the knowledge business, and I have yet to have someone stand up and really take issue with me and say, no, we're in the book caretaking business. No, we're in the circulation and fines business, you know? We really don't care what we circulate. They could be umbrellas on a rainy day. If we're in the knowledge business, we are in the conversation business. Now, this is, I think, okay, great, fine. A little throwaway comment. And, you know, it sort of sounds nice and it sounds very tweetish, and that's great. But it really has some pretty direct ramifications. Because if we're in the conversation business, look at your resource allocations and think about how much of your budget goes towards conversations and how much of it goes towards item management. How much of it goes to stuff and not what we're talking about. And this is really, I want to be real clear here. This is not, oh, burn the books and get rid of them, it's useless. This is not that conversation. What it is it's saying that knowledge creation as a process is vital and important. It's what we're in the business of. And anything that comes out of that process is a secondary object or of secondary importance. So it's my learning and my discussion, and the fact that I wrote the paper or wrote the book out of it is important and useful to convey it, but it's of secondary importance to the fact that I thought it and wrote it. And what's interesting is in this world that we live in, an increasingly ubiquitous connected world, we can get closer and closer to the point of knowledge creation. We can begin to see the academic foment going on. I'm reminded of a Chronicle of Higher Education piece where this editorial was written in. It was basically, academics should not blog. Professors should not blog. And he made two arguments about it, one of which is right, one of which is great, and one of which is complete crap. once again, I'm not going to take the time to vessel it. The right one was, if you blog about your colleagues and how stupid they are and how, you know, it's basic workforce stuff, and you go on interviews and people look at your blog and they see things about your cat and how you don't like these things, it doesn't help you. Okay. The other was, academics and the scholarly community only respect peer-reviewed, completed thought. That, in fact, but tapping on this blog is verbal, you know, just putting it out and thinking out loud, and this is not how academics should be thought. And I just occurred to me, this is 90% of what academics do, is sit there in this academic foment, thrashing back and forth in an idea to figure out what the hell's going on. Right? The paper's the last step. What we've done is we say, oh, well, we only value it after. Why? There is a value to the peer review process and the final material. Don't get me wrong. But in communities such as physics, the time you publish the paper, it's done. It's an archival piece. The real work has happened in the preprint and the online dialogue and the going back and forth. This is the world that we live in. And as academic libraries, if what we're seeking to do is capture the knowledge and facilitate the knowledge creation with our academy, we must realize that we can get closer and closer to the core operations, the core processes within our academy, and not wait till after the fact. ... political comment when the professor has given it away to Elsevier and we had to buy it back and absorb it. Right? So, past says, so what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about what are some of the implications if we're in the conversation business, because we're in the knowledge business, does that change our operations? And why do we need to now make fundamental changes? First, I will say that what's happening is if you can see evidence of this, and I call it the pressure for participation. If, in fact, people learn through conversation, people learn through this back and forth and engagement, then what we see is this pressure for participation. People want to then, therefore, be active constructors of their knowledge. They don't want to be passive. We've gotten rid of the sage of the stage, or my favorite phrase, the bucket model. The bucket model is where you are all sitting out there, and rather than me seeing you as individuals, lovely individuals, by the way, and well-dressed, I see you as buckets. And what I'm doing is throwing out bricks of knowledge that will hopefully hit the bucket. Right? It's an NCAA thing. Right? And so we don't believe that. We believe that we need to be actively engaged. We have so much science on this and knowledge, and it's part of the general rubric, right? The idea that lectures, this, is potentially the worst possible method if I want you to retain the information. And I want you to get hands-on, you'll keep it more, and all this other stuff. So people want to actively construct the knowledge that they're in. And they want the tools that allow and facilitate this process. Now, we see this pressure all over, and I'm going to choose the internet, but we see it all over. In the internet, we look at things like the basic connectivity. 30 years ago, when you talk about wide area networks, you had AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy, BitNet, plus the internet. And if you thought about them as participatory, you were nuts. If you went to AOL and said, I don't like your bandwidth, they say, thank you, go somewhere else. I was wondering if we could filter. No, we don't do that. Right? In software, the idea of if you didn't like AOL's email client, too bad. But what happens is this pressure on the thing that says, no, I want more of a say in a vital infrastructure has led to Prodigy, CompuServe gone. AOL is just an information service provider and connectivity provider on the internet. The idea that we want to actively control our infrastructure. And this discussion of open source, and I will be the first one to tell you that open source is not the panacea. We're in the midst of the hype cycle. That's fine. But what it is, it's a reaction that says, if I am presented with a piece of software that I cannot test, see, taste, kick, feel, break, or pick another one, I don't want it. I want competition and I want openness because I want to have a say in my tools. And this pressure that has happened at the infrastructure level and at the tool level is now sitting at your doorstep. And that doorstep is saying, all right, I want to learn. That's why I'm coming to the library. I want to learn. Now you could say, you want to get your assignment done and it's due in 2 hours. Fine. I want to learn. I want to get a task done. And I show up at my library and I go to your catalogs or I go to your databases or I go to your systems. how able am I to shape them? How can it facilitate a conversation? This drives me nuts. This whole thing about reference librarians, the best search engines. No, they're not. Anyone here wants to stand up and tell me you're a good search engine? Go away. Why? Because you don't do what a search engine does. Give me 20,000 irrelevant pieces of crap and 30 microsystems. You can't do that. Right? That's not what you're in the job of doing. We're going to come back to that later. So we have this pressure for participation. People want to be engaged. People want to be part of the systems. They want to shape it. We see this in the commercial sector all the time. I'll stick in the academic sector. Right? The idea I go into a class and I hate my professor. And I fill out that little form that I never see again. Forget that. I'm going to myprofessorsucks.com and telling you what I really think about him. Right? It started with WalmartSucks.com. I went to Walmart. I had a complaint. They didn't listen. They didn't give me a forum to talk about and shape this world. I go to the internet, $15, GoDaddy.com. I got a site telling you what I really think about you. This pressure that says, if you don't let me shape how I work and what I think about, I'm going elsewhere, is at your doorstep. By the way, you see it in your own staff. When your staff walks up and says, I want a blog, I want a wiki, I want this, and they say, oh, our IT guy can't do that, or we don't have time. Fine. Click, 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 click. Ning.com. You now have an official library presence out on blog, whatever, that you didn't even know about. This pressure is on you as administrators to say, if you won't innovate, this staff can go elsewhere to do it. I don't have to quit. Right? I can host it all myself. So they want these tools to facilitate. Now, we can see a couple of these things in this user's need to participation and their drive for participation. First of all, this is different than users being attracted to good enough information. I am tired of that. Let's stop that one now, too. They go to Google and they go to Amazon because it's good enough. It's not great. It's crappy information. We know it, but it's easy. Well, I hate to break it to you. I work a lot in digital libraries, National Science Foundation, been very, very good to me. And what's interesting is we kept going nuts, going, why aren't we Wikipedia? Why aren't we this? We want people to come and get us information, and they're not. What's going on here? Well, if you look at the collections and things that we are building, what we are saying is come in to us, and we built just as grand facilities online as you have offline. The idea of we build marble and big desks between us and the users, and first of all, they're intimidated to walk in, and then they come in, and we say, now, come to us, ask us questions, because clearly we are now positioned as the experts, even if we say we are not. And why didn't you stop to tell us what you thought? Well, I ran out of there as soon as I could. So what we see, though, is, oh, it's just good enough. The reason they don't use our system is just good enough. Well, here's some interesting data. You don't have to read the numbers, but this is MySpace versus GeoCities. GeoCities is that big line going slowly down at the bottom. MySpace is the other one. Both of these were how to create a personal presence on the internet. Both of them allowed you tools where you could go up and set up personal areas. One of them allowed you to do just about anything, including making ugly, bad, stupid-looking websites, about conversation, about connecting people. The other was pretty static in their rules and their regulations and how they use it. One is not better than the other. One allows participation and built on conversation. The other is not. Or the famous Wikipedia, that would be the blue line going through the stratosphere, and the orange line would be Encarta. Oh, well, that's because one's free or not. Nope, this is the free version of Encarta. Oh, that's because people want bad information? Because one's easier to get to because you have to type a few more characters on a keyboard? No, what's happening is people are looking at Wikipedia. Given everything that was said yesterday, why is it, given everything that was said yesterday, that we still go to Wikipedia and people still add information? And by the way, in an analysis of a major consortial digital reference service that happens to be held somewhere in Dublin, Ohio, find out that it is the third highest referred to site by librarians. Why? Because you can shape it, you can control it, you can add to it, you can do the spectrum of it. Do we like it? Don't we like it? I'm not here for that. What I want to talk about is this isn't a 2-0 discussion. This is a 3-0 and a 4-0 and a 5-0 and a 6-0 discussion, because what we're seeing is a fundamental need on the part of our users to shape the world around them. And why? Because they want to learn. It's not egotism. It's not arrogance. It's not self-aggrandizement. Sure, that's part of it, but ultimately it's because they can shape and actively construct a world around them. Why does Second Life go crazy? Because I don't have to be fat and bald in Second Life, and I can create the world around it. Not that, of course, I am fat and bald. What we need to prepare for is a Dewey level shift in this profession. Good old Melville. Melville changed the world that we lived in. Good, bad, ill. I mean, I'm all for, you know, misogynist, anti-Semitic men from upstate New York. But we're trying to correct that record. What we saw is that he came in and he provided structure and he provided sanity and he changed the idea of profession, libraries, from a niche operation of scholarship to a mass economy of scale driven information world. And yes, there was lots of stuff about literacy, but really it was the right literacy and things that we've changed. But we still have this resonance of this man's effect on the profession. And we are about to hit one that is just as fundamental. And it's because of a couple of things. We already talked about the pressure for participation. What do you mean I have to figure out if it's a 100 or a 200 or a 300? What do you mean if I have to standardize on your way? Because think about the Dewey Decimal Classification System. You can think about Library of Congress. It's much more diffuse. Right? What that classification system, what any classification system is an answer to the basic question of how do you organize the world? Right? And so what we do is we provide these how we structure the world questions, and we get one way of doing it. What if we gave them all? Think about this. The analogy is, what if I sent you out with a task? And I said, I want you to go to Grand Central Station in New York City at rush hour, and I want you to tell me every conversation going on in that room. What would you do? Go nuts. You'd stand on a big chair, visual aids, and you say, thank you! All business people this side of the room. All personal this side. Right? All people having discussions about, you know, staying in office from after affairs this side. Not so fast, Governor Spitzer. It's a New York joke. Right? All business ones. Lawyers here, doctors here. And you keep subdividing them into smaller and smaller groups until you can actually deal with it. Right? Cognitive overload, we break it down and we break the world down to little itty-bitty pieces. Max Weber, the German, loves this crap, right? Now, think about driving to work and listening to the radio. As you drive to work, you have thousands upon thousands of radio signals permeating your body every second of the day. You don't get confused. You don't hear it as a bramble because you have this nice little technology called a radio, and you can tune into just the station you want. You don't stop the other thousand. You don't say, wait for this. You don't have, you can even take things you like on broad ends of the spectrum and put them right next to each other with presets. That's what technology allows us to do. It's not, we don't do it because of technology. Technology allows us to operate the way we do, which is all these conversations happen simultaneously. We need the tools to filter them, not make everyone have the same conversation. Right? That's the pressure for participation. The other one I want to talk about is massive scale information. The fact that we can now be closer to the knowledge creation process and really end up with that all parts of the profession must be ready for radical change. What do I mean by massive scale problem? I was part of a transportation research board, part of the National Academy of Sciences panel, and our job was to figure out how could we manage transportation information more effectively. And I'll be honest. What it turned into was how could libraries of transportation, libraries of academics and state departments of transportation, whatever, do information back and forth. We spent 6 months on, can we get our materials into WorldCat? And I'm willing to take the blame on part of this because it wasn't towards the end of the process that we all looked around at each other and said, you know, transportation information might be more than just a book. Might be more than something we can put into WorldCat. In fact, we came up with this gigabyte per mile problem. Soon, real soon, every mile of road in this country will generate a gigabyte of data a day. A road. Where does that come from? Road sensors. In not in California, you don't have to deal with this, but in New York, we have a salt problem, which is if you put lots and lots of salts and chemicals on a roadway, it makes it safe to drive on and kills all the plants and animals and little furry things by the side of the road. Bad. Right? So what we do is instead, we're actually going to, in the concrete, put these little RFID sensors so that they can basically call and say, "Hi, I'm frozen, come salt me." And only do it when I'm frozen. You don't have to do it in anticipation. Right? The idea of real-time traffic data. Right now they're talking in the Bay Area, they have GPS sensors that tell you where to drive, and while they're telling you where to drive, they're communicating back to websites telling you how fast you're getting there. And all of the people driving that come together and says, boy, these people are really slow, there's a traffic jam there, and I'm going to take that into account. Next person I give directions, I'm going to route it around. It's data moving back and forth. Toll data. If you're in the East Coast, you can drive from Maine down to, I think you can make it all the way to Florida now using something called an Easy Pass, or these, and it's an RFID tag. You put it up in your car, and as you drive through the tolls, it just automatically debits your credit card. You don't have to stop. What's really fascinating about this data, talk about unintended consequences, is while it makes traffic move faster, it's also been a boon to the divorce lawyer industry. Where were you on Thursday, whatever? It's a sick, sad story, but one of my favorites was that a fellow was telling me that his grandmother passed away, and what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to then take this tag out of their car and send it back to Albany, and it charges them for every stop between Buffalo and Albany as the mail truck went down the thruway. Car black boxes, your car telling you how fast you're going, what you're doing, how fast your engine's working. Right? We have cars now that will email you. Oh, my God. That will tell you whether your tires are low or whether your engine's working. All of this comes down to a gigabyte of data per mile. It is assumed that that will become a gigabyte per hour. We've never really been in a world where information goes down. Have you noticed that? Right? As there are 3.5 million miles of highway in the United States alone, that would be 3.3 petabytes of data per hour, or 28 exabytes per year. Exabytes? A byte is one single character. Just one character. A kilobyte is a typewritten page. You can store a typewritten page in 2 kilobytes. Megabyte. A megabyte is usually a high-resolution image, right? Every one of these is an order of magnitude or factor of 10 above the previous. Gigabyte, 20 meters of shelved books. Now, mind you, that's in the Gutenberg style, which we. By the way, if you're worried about Project Gutenberg putting you out of business, what are you doing in your library? Terabytes. 2 terabytes is an academic research library, the text of an academic research library. 2 petabytes are all U.S. academic research libraries combined. Remember, we're getting up to exabytes, folks. Exabyte, 5 exabytes, all words ever spoken by human beings. Ever. I mean, things like wheel on dino. Right? That's in there. In case you're really wondering where we're headed with this, we now have zettabytes, and after that, yottabytes. Strong with the data we are, right? Now remember, this, because I forget where I am in the presentation, remember where we are, is we're talking about it at 2 exabytes, an exabyte of data on just what's going on our highways. Just what's going on our highways. And forget about actually thinking about what's going on. Now, as I mentioned, every one of those is a factor of 10. These are exponential increases in data. And people don't, I'm sorry to do this, I know you're all smart people, but really quickly to give you a sense of what I mean by exponential growth in data. This is a paper experiment, came out of Gladwell's tipping, he mentioned it, came before that. But imagine I give you a very, very, very large piece of paper. Standard width, same piece of paper you got now, but maybe big as this room, big as this hotel, pick whatever you want. And what I want you to do is I want you to fold it in half. All right, this is fun. And I want you to fold that in half again 50 times. All right, just going to fold it, fold it, fold it. By the way, don't try this at home because you get to the point where it's actually taller than it is wide. But anyway, we're in academic, spinning around my head. All right. How tall, and if you've read the book, I don't want you to answer, how tall would that stack be? 50 times, folding 50 times. Now, if you're brave, you say things like refrigerator height. Right? When they did this data, they found, they asked people, oh, phone book? Because that's more than 50 pages. Right? Oh, refrigerator height? Approximately the distance between the Earth and the Sun. What? I have a 50-page book. It's not that big. But remember, what you're doing is you're doubling. So what was, and I can show you the spreadsheet if you really want to see it. If it were 1 inch, you double it and make 2 inches. You double that and make it 4 inches. You double that and make it 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024. And then I'm stuck because all I remember is memory as a geek. But that's what we're talking with exponentially. So when we talk about moving from a petabyte to an exabyte, we're talking that level increase. Now, this isn't just happening in terms of how much data is being generated. We see this things like Moore's Law, that unlike the web, we can all be given a little slack that we didn't see the web coming. All right? That's disruptive change. No one predicted what that was going to do to our life. But unlike that, massive scale computing in terms of storage and processing power is foreseeable. We know it's coming. If you look at something like Moore's Law, storage, Moore's Law, that's what that graph is. It's the number of transistors we can put into a chip, and that, in fact, we double that every 18 months, and we've been on track with Moore's Law, and it's really frightening. And what it really means is that your computer from 18 months from now will be half as capable. Right? And think about what that means is that it was a quarter capable from 2 years, you get the point. And what's amazing is that storage, our ability to store hard drives, is exceeding Moore's Law. We can actually store, make bigger and bigger and bigger and cheaper hard drives faster than we can make bigger and bigger and faster chips, which is pretty damn fast. Right? It's coming. The world is changing. When MIT opened DSpace for the first time to the academics of MIT and said, please give us your articles and papers, what happened was the researchers looked at them and said, I have a 10 terabyte data set to put in there. Is that okay? Right? That's the world we're living in. E-science. NSF is spending huge amounts of money to build scientific facilities that virtualize science that will not generate reams and reams of photographs, but terabytes upon terabytes of data sets. Terascale computing is now passé. It's dead. It's done. We're on petascale computing, and that's even going to be done, and we're going to be on... Right? This is what we're dealing with. The academics are increasingly being expected to deal with this level of data and processing power. And what are you going to do in terms of responding and supporting that? Right? I will tell you that the primary thing that is preventing us from dealing with this is the tyranny of the item. Remember when I mentioned Dewey, how he screwed up the world? There's another fellow by the name of Max Weber, a business, an economist, I believe, in Germany, who developed bureaucracy. And it was the philosophy, it's the reason you're in so many damn meetings. And what it means is, he said, if the world's relatively static, if you divide it up into smaller and smaller and smaller and manageable parts, till you get to the sort of least place you can't break anything down, you assign someone that task and they can report up the structure and we'll know everything about the world. Right? This is reductionism. This is a deductive way of looking at the world. This is what Dewey is. I start with these 10, I can break the 10 into 100 and keep going. Right? The problem is that we bought that wholesale. If you look at what the library's done, how much time do we devote in our journals and in our thinking to what is a document? To what is a document? Now, as was said yesterday, that's a hard question, right? Books look easy, but they're not. But by continuously trying to find the atom, by continuously trying to break the world down to its smallest definable chunk, we are screwing ourselves over. Why? Well, let's take an item. Right? Well, what can we do with this? Well, we can add metadata to it. That'll solve our problem. And here's some metadata. This is XIF data. This is the data your camera probably captured when you took it, what the exposure rate was, what the date was, what the file format is. But that's not useful. So what we need to do, of course, because we're cool and HEP librarians, is we'll put a Dublin Core record together so we can put a Dublin Core record in there. Great. That's fine. That'll do. Oh, wait. No, we need to put this into a library system, so we're going to need a MARC record. Okay, good. We got a MARC record. I'm thinking MARC is pretty stupid when it comes to images, so what we really want to use is mods. Okay, here's mods. Yeah, still not working for me. Let's throw in the NSDL, an OAI record. Yeah, that's kind of interesting, so let's throw in another and another. Does anyone get the feeling that within a year we're going to have 10 megabytes of metadata for every 3K of information in our systems? Right? Because what we constantly do is we're trying to wring blood out of a stone. Think about what we've done. What we do in our exposure is when we take a book, we take the front matter of the book, and we make it really interesting, and we try and figure out how descriptive we can be about that item, ignoring the fact that it's part of a larger discourse. What is the number one thing? What's the number one question you get from faculty in about their fifth or sixth year of service? No, I wish you got one. Citation data? Impact data? Why? Why do academics care about tenure with the citation data? Because they know that what we want to see is impact of a conversation. And so why are we devoting such huge resources to kind of in the front of the book when it's the back of the book that most of our academics find interesting? That's okay. We're going to spend $250,000 on Web of Science to solve that problem. Right? What we're seeing is this tyranny of the item. We have this world where we keep... tag clouds. Need tag clouds. That'll solve the problem. Right? If we keep adding more and more and more junk to this, we miss the fact that knowledge is created through conversation. The knowledge is not inherent in that item. We gave up in the 50s talking about cataloging as exposing data within an item. We know that it is an application of descriptive data to something, and therefore it comes from a conversation and bias of the community. And yet we continually do it and feel that this is the way we can do it. What about the fact that, in fact, this guy's name is Riley? Riley's my son. Riley has a brother. They don't look like that anymore. Right? They used to look like this. I always like to show cute kids. Luckily, they're mine, at least for a couple of years. The point of that is a relationship. Now you go, if we could organize relationships and how these things fit together, why is it when I search into a catalog and I find, our speaker yesterday talked about the fact that he finds one of a volume of 10 and can't, within Google Books, find the others? How many times in your own catalogs can you put things back together as collections? Don't worry, Ferber will solve our problem, right? We have this idea of what happens if this is related to this by something that completely doesn't matter. You know what you have? You have things like syllabi in the faculty. You have a faculty who has to teach a course, and what they have to do is they have to put together a connective piece of tissue called a syllabi. It says, here are these materials that don't come from the same source, same author, are completely unrelated except in the fact that I see them as relevant to this topic. That's connections. Right? Let's face it, your e-reserves are more about relationships than your cataloging is. If we could begin to capture this material over time, we could eventually create really fascinating things. What might something of this look like? What might the difference it makes? Well, let's do the famous Amazon thing. Don't pick on us. We don't like Amazon. Why is Amazon... I'll tell you this. I have a conversation. I've been in these conversations. They drive me nuts. Our site sucks. That's how it always starts. All right, it's got to be better. Let's form a committee. All right, we have our committee to redesign our website. Our website sucks. Why? It's blue. I don't like blue. All right. It will almost invariably turn to, it's too complicated. It's got to be easier. It's got to be simpler. It's got to be more like... or... This is the complete record for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone from the WorldCat. Right? That's a screen dump. You can go ahead and read it if you'd like. That's below the fold, the whole thing. This is the same record in the Onondaga County Public Library. National Library of Australia, Library of Congress record. Simpler, easier. No one scrolls Amazon. Amazon. Oh, it's all that marketing crap. Marketing crap. If you didn't see it, look really, really, really far up the top, you'll see a light blue line. What's the rest of this record? Sales data, which is really bibliographic data. It's the ISBN number, it's the publisher, it's a price. The next one is sales recommendations. If you like this, you'll also like this. Quality reviews. New York Times book review says it right at the item level. Next one, bibliographic data. And by the way, if you take that light blue and that orange and combine it, it's not that different than the others. So what else is here? Recommendations based on what you purchased before. Reviews. Pathfinders. Remember when we used to do pathfinders? Discussion tools such as wikis and online forums, and only at the bottom do you get some more marketing data. The vast majority of that record is not about the item. It is about the people who read the item and what they think of the item. And I'll tell you, if you look at a lot of those comments, they're like, if you like this, you'd also like that. Or this wasn't quite as good as their other book. They're creating conversations. When people go to Amazon and they say, I want to tell you what I think about this book. Why? Because they are learning, they want to shape their environment. Amazon says shape it. And they're beginning the first steps. If you look, by the way, at more recent versions of this, what you will see is you will see citations to and from this book. They're building conversations. They're letting people shape knowledge, and people are going nuts for it. Is the fact that Amazon is brilliant at search engines why most of us started Amazon to find a book and then go to our library catalogs to see if we have it? No. They're really good at the data that we are searching. There's different things because I'll tell you, the more and more time we spend on word collocations within metadata, the less and less time we're going to get the point. The point is, we have no more blood to wring out of the metadata stone of our items. We cannot find full text. Fine, full text. But even that won't get you what you want. You want to know how these things are related to me. And so when I look at library systems and I think, what's the future library system look like? I don't think it looks like Amazon, frankly. You know what I think it looks like? You're waiting. No. This is a result of a week of intensive work that I spent at OCLC and what we were doing is thinking about what could question point of the future look like. And all right, I'll be fair. All right, there's the interface. This is what we did is we started thinking about what does reference look like and how might it work in this conversational way where people are shaping their information. And we called it Scapes. And so we're going to take a quick scenario, and what we're going to do in Scapes is we're going to start with, I'm going to come into this system, and I want to know about Rich Girl. I'm listening on the car, I hear this song called Rich Girl by Gwen Stefani. I want to sort of know more about it. So I do a quick search for Rich Girl, and I find the MP3 file, and I drag it into this space. It's nice click-drag stuff. And when I click on that, I can get the sort of standard stuff that you get. I can find all this nice little metadata to it, such as, well, the artist was this and this, and the album came off of here, and it had a release date and so on. And in fact, if I click on the album, I can actually get a nice hard record to this. This is all, we can do this now with our bibliographic data. Please, Dave, you just unproved your point. Leave me alone. But what's also interesting is that doesn't quite get me what I want because I'm trying to figure out what this thing is all about. This has got yodeling, and I know I've heard this song before somehow. What's going on here? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite a friend in to help me think about this. Now, that friend might be that little librarian thing at the bottom where I want to bring an expert in, but I'm actually going to bring my friend in. I'm going to bring Jeff Panka because I like picking on him. And I'm going to say, hey, Jeff. Do you know where I can find the lyrics to the song? And Jeff's going to go over, and he's going to do a search on the same interface we're working on together. And he's going to go ahead and says, you know what? Here's someone else has already done this with the lyrics. They've already put this together. I'm going to bring it in. And so he drags it in, creates this relationship. And I can now see the lyrics, and I can read them together. And what's interesting is they also were confused by the lyrics. So they've gone ahead and created a whole set of links based on the lyrics, such as, in my Galliano gown, and I'm going to get me four Hayuku girls, uh-huh. And I go, oh, what? And so, in fact, I can click on that, and they've built a relationship between that And I find out those are, in fact, Gwen Stefani's backup dancers. And, in fact, it's linked to Wikipedia, where I can find out that Hayuku is a really fashionable metro subway exchange in Japan. And, in fact, that's where they came from. That's cool. And now I can go, that's great, but I know I've heard this somewhere before. I'm going to go ahead and bring in another expert. This time I am going to bring a librarian in. And I'm going to say, hey, do you know if this song is a remake of something? And she goes, actually, it's a remake of a song from Fiddler on the Roof. I'm going to go ahead and add this information. And so they can, with the same tools available to me, can go ahead and add a whole different section where now they've linked Rich Girl up here to Fiddler is a remake of a song called If I Were a Rich Man, which is part of Fiddler on the Roof, and here's the rest of the song albums. I could say, that's great, fine, wonderful, we sign off. Now, Jeff, being Jeff, is driving home that night, and he hears another Gwen Stefani song. He says, you know what? He also remade one from The Sound of Music, more yodeling. And so he goes ahead and adds this. Now, this does not look like a search engine. This does not look like what graphics we add to it. What we're seeing now is that we see a conversation taking place, technology in the library is facilitating that, and we see it's about the relationships of items, not adding more stuff to the items. Because the notion of adding noise to the catalog as a bad thing is back to our thinking about we're in rush hour in Grand Central, right? We want it to be we want our libraries to be noisy places now. Why don't we want our catalogs to be noisy places? Our catalogs should have all this data coming in and out of it with great tools to blend it and get away if we want. Now, what's also interesting is if you look at the back end of what's happening with this system, what we end up with is, yes, a set of items. A set of items, but more importantly, we have the relationships between these items that never existed before. I would never have put Gwen Stefani next to the Fiddler on the Roof because one's a soundtrack and one's popular. Well, boom, they're right there. They make a connection. And we have that relationship together, and we can take that relationship and we can display it back into our Escapes interface, but we can display it on a cell phone interface that's just a linear chat. We can take it into a learning management system such as Blackboard, or we can do a standard IM stuff. Reference librarians get very excited about this. But what's more interesting is this wonderful little, I stole from Apple Spotlight search, where did it come from? It came from an aggregation of all of those connections. You know, you're not the only one that made that connection. 500 other people made that connection. Is that interesting? Now, that's the power of social networking. But it's not a 2-0 whiz-bang where we have friends and we're just connecting. I'm on LinkedIn. I have friends. I don't know half the people on LinkedIn, too. All right, let's be honest. That doesn't really help me, but the notion that I can now connect disparate information and begin to aggregate it together to find whole new ways of organizing information, that gets me excited. And you know what? In a linear world, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of millions of billions of bits and documents and data. Or as we can say, we can no longer talk about a number being astronomically large because we're going to have more data than we do stars in the sky. We are now talking library large information. We need people willing to, and need to give tools for people to do this because we cannot do it all. Librarians are vital, important, and valuable people who will be with us for a century, but we are going to be on a team, folks. We're going to be on a team, and we're going to be on a team with professionals. We're going to be on a team with marketers and technology folks, but we're going to be on a team with average schmoes and undergraduates and people who frankly shouldn't give us their opinion, but we're going to deal with it. And you know why? Because libraries in this crazy, mixed-up, strange Web 2.0, 3, 4, 5, 6.0 world are perfectly situated. This is not a doom and gloom meeting. I will not stand any more of what's going to put us out of business. Libraries are perfectly situated for the world we're in. Why are we perfectly situated for the world we're in? Because we are, first of all, function as authorities and not authoritarians. What does that mean? We are honest brokers and facilitators of conversations. I have an ongoing argument, I think I've won it now, but I'm not sure, with a former advisor of mine, Mike Eisenberg, and what he wants to do is he says libraries should replace Google. Unfortunately, he calls it Google, but he said, imagine if libraries built Google. Wouldn't it be great? They pick only the good stuff. And I look at it and I say, how the hell do they know what the good stuff is? They're librarians. We train them to know it. I said, no, we don't. I said, absolutely not. A librarian has no better feel for what is good and bad information in the world than any other class of people in the world.
Ooh.
Don't worry, you'll like where it's going. If I show you a site and you look at it and you say, this is good, this is bad, and I ask you why, you come up with things like, well, it's got numbers on it, it's a .edu and a .... and just garbage, folks. I'm sorry. If you give me another checklist that tells me what 10 things to look in a website, I'll tell you what. I'll take the checklist, I'll give it to the malicious person who wants to put up bad information, and they'll use it as a formula to fool you. Right? Checklists don't work. Why? Because we librarians know, and what my librarians make supremely well situated, is that librarians know that what good information and bad information is solely based on the context of the user. We know good and bad information for you. Given a question, a bad example, but I'll do it anyway. A reporter walks into a librarian, a reporter walks into a library in San Francisco, anything goes. Reporter walks into a library and they ask the reference librarian, I'm doing an article on the use of the web to recruit people into hate organizations. Can you give me some good or bad websites? And they point them to the Ku Klux Klan website. Eighth grader walks in, asks for cool after school programs, maybe not the same website. Right? Does that mean that the Ku Klux Klan website is a bad site? What does bad mean? It means for the reporter it was good, and for the eighth grader it was bad. That's what makes librarians special. That's why we are authorities and not authoritarians, and why I get really, really worried when I hear people's reaction to this massive, overwhelming information that we will build fortresses on the hill and in them we will store the ark of good knowledge. Give me a break. And the idea that somehow I talked to the idea of, can we use reference data in part of our collection development, had a collection person look at me and go, we build collections for the next generation. That's great. I hope we are here. That we have to also realize that librarians are tool builders. Tool builders. Tool builders. Librarians, unfortunately, have been known to shy away from technology, and it is wrong. And I will tell you, the classic joke is, technology, IT people never say no. You ever know? What they do is they just start answering in lots of three-letter acronyms. We'd like to put this database online. Oh. Well, we're going to have an LDAP problem. People are going to have to VPN in through the firewall, and we're going to have to do some TCPI tunneling, and by the way, we're going to have to do an LDAP look at, and then, of course, we're going to have to do the IP allocation, which means we're going to have to play with the DNS. And nowhere did they say no, but that's what they said. And you look and you say, oh, those horrible. And you want to know why I know techie people are? We need to add this book to the collection. Oh. Well, we're going to have to do a MARC record with AACR2, and AACR2 may not do it, so we'll have to bring in the Getty Thesaurus, and then if the Getty Thesaurus isn't because of the image, we have to do mods. Mods, the TEI is not going to work, that's pretty much it. That's the same damn thing! We are technical people! We need to realize that when we put together Pathfinder, tool. When we design our website, tool. When we design our seating area to facilitate conversation of undergraduates, tool! We're tool builders. And what we need to start doing is we need to stop trying to find and take the next technology wave. We need to stop trying to ride the wave, and we need to become wave machines. What we need to do is we need to determine what's the next killer app for our users. And Google can't do it. And Amazon can't do it. Elsevier can't do it. And I'll tell you this. Intelligent interfaces can't do it alone. They don't know our users the way we do. And so we must be seen as being in the business of tool building and not simply mass adopters of other people's technology. I don't think we're in the same business as Amazon because we don't have to worry about selling the books. I don't think we're in the same business as Google because Google doesn't house the materials necessarily. Google is about finding stuff, not making sense or context of stuff. It's the same thing that drives me nuts. I don't think Sears is in the same business that we are. Huh? They've got a help desk. You can call them with questions. We got reference desks. You can call them with questions. Same business. Right? That's our problem, is that we have a kissing cousin in Google and we assume that they're beating us at a different job. We need to stop chasing and need to start making our own things. The other thing that we are perfectly situated to do is we can provide connective tissues within our academy, because no one has ever accused the academy of being a flat organization. We didn't just invent the concept of stovepipes. We went out and helped build them. We had to do a study first about it and talk about the physics of it, but we are a stovepipe organization.
I'm an information scientist. I'm an iSchool guy. I'm a biologist. I'm a this. I'm a that. Right?
Let's face it, the way you get ahead in academia, I'm perfectly willing to look at myself, right, is you take any domain that you want to be a part of and you keep subdividing it until you are the biggest player in it. How do I know this?
I'm a library science faculty.
Well, I deal in reference. I deal in digital reference. I deal with systems in digital reference. I deal with Dave's third toenail on the left thing because I can get it published. Right? This is the world we live in. And who is better situated to tie all that stuff back together than you? They all come to you. They all should deposit information with you. We'll talk about depositories later. The idea is you guys can pull hooks into these stovepipes. And you can say, you know what, Dave? You're screwed. But that's okay. We like that. Stay just as dysfunctional as you are, and we'll connect you. We're going to find out when someone comes in with the same question from two radically different disciplines that maybe we can link these people together. That when the provost comes up with yet another interdisciplinary incentive package, that maybe we could be the interdisciplinary incentive package. That we can combine this information, that we can put these things together, that we can do it. Because that's the job that we are in. But we must be prepared. We must be prepared as radical, subversive change agents. As I'll tell you this, I'm going to pick on me again, library science education, we are very fond of saying we teach leaders. And I'll tell you what, we do them a disservice.
We teach leaders.
It's back to libraries and the knowledge business. It's so damn easy to say. But I'll tell you what, you guys don't want to hire a library director for a 101 position. We teach leaders. What oftentimes, unfortunately, that means is we give them a grand vision, some technology tools, and we throw them into the wilds. I'm perfectly willing to do that. What we need to teach are change agents. And that the reason we do is because you guys need to fix your innovation cycle. What does that mean? Repeat after me, new hires are not the solution. What do I mean? You should change your website. Oh, yeah. You know what? You should talk to Betty. Betty's new and young, and we just hired her, and Betty knows the web. And it doesn't matter if Betty could be 98 years old. She's still young and new because you just hired her. Right? I have seen in way too many cases that libraries use their hiring cycle as their primary, if not only, innovation cycle. We hire them because they're new, they have new skills, and unfortunately what that means is sometimes we hire them so we don't have to get those new skills ourselves. And so what do? We put the onus on the newest employee with the least cultural knowledge, the least experience, and the least seniority with the highest priority task in the library, and we wonder why they go crazy and leave. Because we set them up for failure. What we need to do is think about not only hiring the Bettys. Hire the Bettys. I train them. That keeps me in job. That's good. But then what about the libraries that I go to that provide 40 hours of continuing education to every library staff, mandatory part of the evaluation process? What about the idea of creating cycling innovation teams? What about the idea of creating a continuing education section? Because we can't find an economic model in library science schools. You guys do it. And I'm telling you, sending them to ALA once every 30 years ain't it. Right? We need to fix our innovation economy. We have to look at the idea that our library systems need to evolve and change. I argue that library vendors must become marketplaces and not full solutions. What do I mean? If this world is changing so fast and at such scale, and we are tool builders, the idea that we go to one vendor and assume them to solve every problem we have is insane. It is unfair to us, and it is unfair to them. I will not pick on Innovative. I'll pick on another company. Question point. They said, you know, I can't tell you the number of times we go in and talk about what a reference offer should look at, and they bring out this contract that they got from another library in their consortium, and it has nothing of what they care about, all this legacy garbage, and we sign it, and now we're obligated. And for 5 years, we just keep this accretion. We just keep, like, throwing, what is it, lipstick on a pig. We just keep taking a bad contract and augmenting it. And stifles innovation across the field. What we need to start thinking about is Innovative is a great core system. But what we need to do is the guy in Boise who comes up with the good idea, or Scotland, he can, in essence, go in and start offering his wares. And now what happens is the library vendors, rather than putting it in their chain where they're going to get to it eventually, just make it available. They provide the infrastructure. And frankly, just like Apple's doing with their iPhones, Apple's a great example. I mean, everyone likes to pick on Apple in a good way. So, you know, what's amazing is when Apple put this out, within like 2 days, people had fixed it so they could make it the way they wanted it to. And Apple sort of for a long time tried to break all the hacks that people came up with. And finally, Apple went, oh, whoa, what are we doing? We have a dedicated innovation community that wants to hack and improve our products, which is going to build brand loyalty. Why are we trying to stifle that innovation? What we're going to do is give you the tools to make your own thing. You put it up. We're going to provide you an e-commerce infrastructure for you to get rewards back. And what we'll do is take 30%. 7% of profit. If you don't want to charge anything, we take zero. They get zero. We just share it in the community. But now what happens is Apple has increased their developer base by, you know, 3 million. Right? And so the idea that somehow we have to create closed-end systems. I'm not here to talk open source as a religion. I'm here to talk simply about the idea that if we could scale the infrastructure of which our library technology vendors can work by incorporating our expertise in it, it benefits them and it benefits us. And so we need, this isn't an open source, it's simply a reality that too much is going on for any one unit. Your organization to keep track of. And so the idea needs to become a focus on the API and not the interface. But ultimately, and here's where I'm going to end because I've gone too long, is that we have an obligation. The people in this room, this is my last statement of my argument, which is you and I have an obligation of leadership. I used to think a lot about why people become deans and directors. And I used to think of it as, you know, sort of something that was easily passed off, particularly faculty. It's easy for us to look at deans as people who didn't want to do research anymore or sell out, this kind of thing. Or that they were terribly, you know, driven and they were in careerism and they just were trying to do it for the glory. You guys feel glorious, don't you? And it took me a while, but it finally dawned on me that the best leaders are ones that take on the mantleship of leadership, not out of personal glory, but out of obligation, that we are, in fact, stewards of these organizations. That obligation means not that just you need to spend time in your committees and you need to spend time on budget issues and you need to deal with provosts. It means that you have an obligation, the entire profession, Betty, the first-year librarian, has an obligation, to lead, to innovate, to stimulate. That we must now look at our jobs as facilitators of conversations, yes, but ultimately as innovators. That the future, if libraries are out of business in 10 years, you know whose fault it is? And mine. The idea is that we must accept our mission to facilitate this thing, and that we must realize that libraries as facilitators does not mean that we are an unbiased or invisible. I would argue that there is no such thing as an unbiased librarian. The minute you have a question and you go to the keyboard or you go to a book, you've shown a bias. The minute you take your budget and decide whether it goes into materials, personnel, or training, you've shown a bias. We are biased human beings. Our brains are geared to make decisions quickly. We do that by coming up with heuristics and functions. This is how we work. The point is not that we don't have them. The point is that as a field, we are principled enough to at least expose them before other people run into them. And we're not invisible. We are not invisible. The best example of service is not librarians who disappear, but librarians who say, I'm here, I'm active, and I've got a point of view. My job is to get you to be the most successful that you can be. And sometimes that means I got to tell you no. And sometimes that means I got to tell you you're wrong. And sometimes that means I got to say that's a dumb question. Right? That in fact, we must and ultimately be brave, be bold, and be right. It is our obligation as leaders to be brave, to look at the new vendors, to look at new opportunities, to look at our economic difficulties, to look at our institutions, and to bravely stand up and say, we are wrong, we are right, this is where we're going, this is where we're headed. Be willing to make a statement, to listen, but ultimately to speak. That we need to be bold in our ideas. It is not time for us to think incrementally. It is not time for us to say, if we throw Dublin Core at our catalog, we fix the problem. Z3950 didn't solve the problems because it, frankly, was not a bold solution. Google was a bold solution. Why? Because they said, you know what? If you don't find something, 404 error, that's okay. Here's 10,000 other things to look at. That is a bold statement. For me to look at you and say, the era of item-based metadata is dead, is a bold statement. But we need to be right. That in order to be brave, in order to be bold, in order to make the changes, in order to make sure that we are successful for the next 100,000 years, we need to consciously talk to each other, match talk to each other, combine resources into research, combine resources into best practices, network together, experiment like crazy, but be willing to pull a plug. That ultimately, our goal as librarians is to improve the society of which we are a part of. And that is not a minor task. And that is not a task that any Gutenberg or Google could ever put out of things, because we are an aspirational organization. We represent the grandest ideas of humanity, that knowledge and education are essential to the well-being and operation of any society. And that is the mantle that we need to take on. Thank you very much.